Kids, you're dismissed to Children's Church. And for those of you who are still in the building, will you go ahead and pass those booklets down the aisle one more time? Maybe you already signed them when Pastor Rob was up here, but we'd like to just send them through the aisle one more time. Just the sign-in sheets, just in case you came in a little bit late and you can sign in and you can do so right now. We recognize that sometimes people come in a little bit later and we just want to give you an opportunity. We don't do anything with that information, but just welcome you and just see if you have any questions about our church if you're new. Now, last week, we started a new series in the book of Judges. And we did an overview last week talking about how we struggle, even as followers of Christ, of doing things my way or the world's way instead of God's way. Today, we're going to look at chapter 1. Now, the lesson that God is going to teach us today reminds me of those automatic walkways that you find in the airports. Have you ever been on one of those? Now, imagine that you're walking the wrong way on one of those automated walkways. If you're walking, you can make some movement forward, correct? But if you ever stop walking, what happens? You don't move forward. You don't stand still. You start walking backwards, right? Now, the Christian life can feel like that sometimes, can even be that way sometimes. Our Christian walk is often described as that, a walk. It's not like we're walking uphill or downhill. We're just supposed to continue walking forward in life following Christ. But unfortunately, the world, the flesh, and the devil are flowing against us. And if we decide that we're tired and exhausted, and we really just don't want to do this anymore, we need a break, and we stand still in our walk with Christ, what happens to you? You start going backwards, don't you? This is often what we experience when we allow our culture to influence us. It's not that we stand still in our walk with Christ. We feel that movement backwards, and we cry out to God for help. Now, that's what we're going to see in our passage today as we look at the Israelites as an example. In fact, I'm going to give you the takeaway in the very beginning here of what this passage that we're going to look like is all about. This first chapter, and we're going to look at a little bit of chapter 2 as well, is telling us to follow through with what God calls you to do in your life, or you will suffer heartache in this life. Follow through with the life God has called you to live in Jesus Christ, because if you don't, you will start moving backwards. This is what the Israelites found out in our passage today. And what we'll do this morning is look at what God called the Israelites to do, to go in and conquer the promised land. And he said, I will be with you when you do this. I will give you victory. You need me. You're dependent on me to accomplish this task that I've called you to do. But we will see that Israel has some success and some failures. Just like we feel as Christians, as we follow God, we're going to have some successes and some failures. But a lot of times as Christians, we act like the Israelites. We're going to go in and try to do it in our own strength to have victory. And as a result, we are successful in the beginning usually, but then it gets exhausting because our willpower and our strength can only do so much. And we start saying like, God, this is just too hard. We stand still. And all of a sudden, we feel ourselves moving backwards. Not because we didn't try hard enough. We're a bunch of tryhards, honestly, in Christianity. We try hard all the time. But I'll tell you what, if all you're doing is trying hard, you're going to fail. See, what the Israelites had to realize is that their victory depended on God, not themselves. It's the same thing that is true in our Christian walk, which is what we'll talk about today. That to have victory following Jesus is not dependent on you alone. If you're a tryhard, you will fail. You've experienced this. And you wonder, and you say, God, why do I keep failing? Why do I keep going along with my culture? Part of the reason might be because you have not died to yourself and told God, I need you. I am solely dependent on you. There is nothing I can do through my own strength. I can't be successful unless I am walking with you, holding your hand forward. That's what the Israelites didn't realize. And as a result, one of the consequences is they suffered great heartache, not only in the generation that went into the promised land to conquer it, but in generations to come. So what we're going to do is look at the first chapter in the book of Judges, and then we're going to look at chapter 2, the beginning part, to see the consequences. So we're going to open our Bibles to Judges chapter 1, and we got a lot to read through. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read things in sections. I'm going to show you some maps up here, because when they start talking about areas and cities and everything, I'm like, I have no idea where this is. So my hope is that this will help you understand sort of what the Israelites are doing as they're going into the promised land. You're going to see the successes and failures, so we're going to talk about that. Then we're going to look at the consequences, and then we're going to talk about how this is similar to our walk with Christ, and we can learn from the Israelites' mistakes. Now, as we go through this section in Judges chapter 1, there's going to be these sections where we're talking about the tribes of Israel, and they're going to refer to them almost as like, this is a person, Judah and Simeon. What's happening here is they're using the fathers of these tribes. These were the 12 sons of Jacob. You had Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. Joseph actually got a double blessing, and so there's a tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh. Levites were the priests, so the tribe of Levi got no land, so that's how you get 12, even though there's sort of 13. Okay, you guys got that? So we're going to see how each of these tribes did. And actually, there's going to be some omission of two of the tribes, actually three of the tribes. Gad and Reuben aren't going to be talked about because their territory was on the east side of the Jordan. This chapter is focusing on things that the Israelites are conquering on the west side of the Jordan. And Issachar is not talked about at all in this chapter, but it gets talked about a little bit later on, and one of the judges is actually from that region. So there's a lot of information. Take it as you will. Let's get into this chapter and see how God gave them a call to go promise or to conquer the promised land, and he said he would be with them, and this is what happened. Let's begin by looking at the first seven verses. Now, after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, "Who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" And the Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hands." It's a pretty big promise. That's awesome. So Judah said to Simeon, his brother, "Come up with me to my allotted territory, that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I will likewise go with you to your allotted territory." And Simeon went with him. Then Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hands, and they killed 10,000 men at Bezek. And they found Adonai Bezek in Bezek and fought against him, and they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Then Adonai Bezek fled, and they pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. And Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to gather scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me." Then they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. Let's stop right there and just examine how the Israelites did in the very beginning. So God gives them this order to go in, and Judah is supposed to go up first. And it actually makes sense that he would take the tribe of Simeon with him, for several reasons. Their territory that they were going to conquer was in the same area. Actually, these two sons of Jacob come from the same mother, Leah. And also, Simeon had a very small amount of people in their tribe, so it kind of made sense from a logical perspective that these two would go forward. And what do we see in the very beginning as they go in to conquer the promised land? We see success. They go in and they wipe them out. But do you see, though, in the very beginning here, there seems to be a problem. It seems like they edited God's commands a little bit. You see, God said, go into the promised land and do one of two things. Either exterminate them or evict them. But what do they do with this king, Adonai Bezek? They cut off his thumbs and his big toes, basically making him ineffective to fight an enemy military battle in the future. But is that what God told the Israelites to do to the people they captured? No. God did not tell them to go in and then capture them and do to these people what they have done to other people. He didn't tell them to take prisoners and torture them. He told them, kill them or evict them, right? So here we get a little glimpse of people letting the culture that they're entering infect the way they treat other people. It'd sort of be like some absurd thing like this. If we came into the land of America, and the way they dealt with people who ran through red lights was to slash their tires on their cars. When we conquered the land, we would do the same thing to those who ran red lights. That would be absolutely ridiculous. I know that's a terrible example, but just go with it. No, the Israelites weren't supposed to go in and torture people. They were supposed to just kill this king. So here, in the very beginning, even though God says, Judah, you go up first. Okay, you have success. But all of a sudden, they let the culture that they just entered start infecting them a little bit and doing what they do to their prisoners. That's not what God said. Well, let's continue on and see how the story continues. Let's look at verses 8 and 9. Now the children of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it. They struck it with the edge of the sword and they set the city on fire. And afterwards, the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites who dwelt in the mountains in the south and in the lowlands. So again, you can kind of see up here that they went to Bezek first. Then they kind of go up a little bit. It's not too far away from Jerusalem. They go and conquer, it appears, what probably is actually the lower half of Jerusalem, which is present day called Mount Zion. There may have been an upper city because Jerusalem's going to show up again when the Benjamite goes in and they fail to conquer Jerusalem, so it's kind of confusing. It seems like there's a couple areas there in Jerusalem. This tribe of Judah conquers at least the lower section and has success again. So again, we see God working and they have success in the beginning over the Canaanites. So far, so good. Let's continue on. Let's look at verses 10 through 15. Then Judah, same tribe, went up against the Canaanites who dwelt in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron was formerly Kirjath Arba, and they killed Sheshai, Ahiam, and Talmai. And from there they went against the inhabitants of Debir. The name of Debir was formerly Kirjath Sefer. Then Caleb said, whoever attacks Kirjath Sefer and takes it, to him I will give my daughter Aksha as wife. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. So he gave him his daughter Aksha as wife. Now it happened when she came to him that she urged him to ask her father for a field. And she dismounted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, what do you wish? So she said to him, give me a blessing. Since you have given me land in the south, give me also springs of water. And Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. Okay, again, we see success, don't we? They attack these two cities. That is actually fantastic. If you don't know the history of Israel, these two areas right here, especially Hebron, was very significant in the early days. If you go to Numbers 13, when the Israelites first came up to the Promised Land and were investigating if it is a place that is full of milk and honey and rich resources, they go in there and they find that it is. But they encounter the city, one of the cities, Hebron, and it has some people in there that are very big and very tall and some high walls, and they look at that and say, we can't take this land. And it actually was Joshua and Caleb who said, yes, we can. But the people disobey God and they go wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. Now they come back to the same city. And here we have them victorious over the people they thought they could not conquer. And who gave them that victory? This isn't a trick question. It starts with a G, ends with an odd. God, right? God gave them victory. And everybody in this section of this historic account is seen in a good light, right? We have Caleb is seen like, wow, look at this guy is a good leader. Othniel says, I'll go conquer it, no problem. Aksha, Caleb's daughter and the wife of Othniel, seems to be very analytical and bold and asks for things. I mean, this is a good account of people trusting the Lord and following him and believing that he can give them victory over what the Israelites once thought they could not conquer. Do you see that? So this is a success story right here. This is amazing. We should look at this and go, wow, I can't believe this. But let's continue on and see how they do. Judges chapter 1, verses 16 through 20. Now the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of Palms with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the south near Arad. And they went and dwelt among the people. That's not good. And Judah went with his brother Simeon, and they attacked the Canaanites who inhabited Zephah and utterly destroyed it. That's good. So the name of the city was called Hormah, which means destruction. Also, Judah took Gaza with its territories, Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. So the Lord was with Judah, and they drove out the mountaineers. But they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. Stop right there. I was a little harsh. If you look on your outline, and those of you at home too, if you go to flip over to the back, I kind of gave you an overview, and we're going to look at that. I was actually a little harsh when I first looked at this, and I kind of said they failed at everything, and that's not true at all. They did have some success here, right? They did take Zephah. They did take Ekron. They did take Ashkelon. They did take Gaza. They did have some success, but there was a problem. They didn't take the entire lowlands because the people there had chariots of iron. Now, let me just mention these cities. These are going to pop up a little bit later on in Judges. And what happens here is that we see the Israelites actually take this area and have victory. God gave them victory over this area. But we're going to see in a little while, just a few decades later, the Philistines are going to retake control of this, and there's going to be a big mess. So they did have victory, and then they allowed it to be taken by the enemy, and they no longer had victory in the area they once had victory. Does that make sense? And they also made an excuse. Did God give them victory over their enemies in this section of this historic account? The answer is yes. I'm trying to help you out here. Come on, this is interactive. I'm trying to keep you awake. Okay? Yes. But when did they make an excuse? When did it get too hard? Well, God, they got chariots of iron. I mean, it's just too big for us. You're not big enough to help us defeat that foe. We might as well leave them alone. So here we encounter another excuse the Israelites come up against. When they look at the enemy and it looks too big to conquer, what do they decide to do with that enemy? Let it be. We can't take on that stronghold. That's just too big for us, Lord. How often do you do that in your Christian walk with Christ? There's something that the enemy has a hold of, something you've struggled with your entire life, perhaps, and you have some victory for a while, but there's that one area that's just so hard to go and conquer. The excuse might be technology. Ah, God, I don't want to give that up. I can't take that away because, man, that just is so important to me. I just can't do it, Lord. That's just an area we can't control or conquer right now. Oftentimes, that kind of weeds its way back in our life, and where we once had victory, all of a sudden it gets taken over by the enemy again. Have you ever experienced that with a sin that you struggle with? The Israelites struggled with the same thing, although this was actually going and conquering a land. So, they did have victory. But there's also failure here to take the lowlands because their excuse was technology. Even though God had gave them victory, all of a sudden he wasn't big enough to give them victory. You see that? And unfortunately, there's repercussions not just during their lifetime, but for generations to come. Let's continue on. Let's look at verse 21. I'm just going to look at that one verse. But the children of Benjamin. Okay, so we were talking about the tribe of Judah and Simeon. Now we're finally going to another tribe. But the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. Here we have a massive failure. And their excuse, it seems like, is tolerance. God said, go in, wipe them out, or evict them. But you know, those Jebusites, man, they were just too hard. And instead of driving them out, you know, God, we'll just live alongside them. And they'll just live alongside us. It'll be okay. You know, I'll still have victory, but I'll just let it be, Lord. I'm not strong enough to overcome it. You're not strong enough to overcome it. We'll just let them live alongside us. And this book of Judges was likely written during the time of Samuel, between Saul and David, and those Jebusites still lived in Jerusalem until David went and conquered them. We can do the same thing, can't we? You know, Lord, that sin, it's hard. I'm struggling with it, but you know what? I'm just going to tolerate it. I'm just going to let it live alongside me. You know, I have some victory, but there's going to be some failure, but I'll just let it just kind of live alongside me, Lord. It's just too big. I can't overcome it. Have you ever experienced that before? Let's continue on. Let's look at verses 22 through 26. In the house of Joseph. Now, the house of Joseph. Joseph was a son of Jacob. Got his name changed to Israel. Joseph got a double blessing, and that is the tribe of Manasseh and Ephraim that we're going to be talking about. So the house of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, sent men to spy out Bethel. The name of the city was formerly Luz. And when the spies saw a man coming out of the city, they said to him, "Please show us the entrance to the city, and we will show you mercy." So he showed them the entrance of the city, and they struck the city with the edge of the sword. But, it's always those buts, isn't it? But they let the man and his family go, and the man went to the land of the Hittites, built a city, and called its name Luz, which is its name to this day. Okay, so once again, there is success here, right? They take Bethel, and you can see where Bethel is on this area, which was amazing. That's great. There's some victory there. And they go in and they find a man. It seems like the entrance to the city. I don't know exactly why it was veiled and they didn't know how to get into the city, but they find a man and they, like they did with the spies did with Rahab, is, hey, help us out, get into the city, and we'll spare you and your family. And that happened well for Rahab. Here we have another instance where this man is spared and the city's conquered. But what did they let that guy go do? They said, okay, you can't stay here, but you can go there. Okay, part of that, it was acceptable, is evict them from the land. But what did the guy do with his Canaanite culture? Rahab was welcome into the culture, and she adapted to the Israelites' culture to worship the one true God. Did this guy go away and worship the one true God? No, he goes away to the land of the Hittites. Okay, that's good. But he brings all of his culture, all of his customs, all the false gods that he worships, makes another city, and calls it by the same name. That's not exactly what you want when you conquer your enemies. And it's going to become a problem to the Israelites later on in generations to come. So once again, we see them editing God's commands in a way, not necessarily meaning to make a failure to happen in the future, but allowing it to happen in the future. Do you see that? I have victory now, but I allow it to go away, and then I'm going to come back to it later, and I'm going to have failure. That's what we're going to see with the Israelites. Let's continue on with this historic account, looking at the land that they were to conquer. Verses 27 and 28. However, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and its villages, Taanach in its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor in its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam in its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo in its villages. For the Canaanites were determined to dwell in the land. And it came to pass, when Israel was strong, that they put the Canaanites under tribute, but did not completely drive them out. So Manasseh goes into this key area, actually, in Israel, where it goes into the Jezreel Valley. And Beth Shean is sort of at the entrance of that valley. It was a strategic point. They go in, but they fail. They fail to drive the people out of this key historic military place. And even when they did become strong enough, what did they do with those Canaanites? They allowed them to stay. So as they first came in, God would have given them victory if they had depended on Him. But they allow them to stay. And then when they do become strong enough, they allow them to stay. Epic failure on Israel's part. Let's continue on. And we're going to go very fast through these remaining because it's kind of hit different tribes real quick. But we'll stop and just look at the failure in each one of them. Judges 1:29. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer. So the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them. Success or failure here? Say it a little bit louder. Failure, right. Let's go on and look at the next section, verse 30. Nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron, or the inhabitants of Nahalol. So the Canaanites dwelt among them, and they were put under tribute. Success or failure? Failure, once again. Verses 31 through 32. Nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants of Akko, or the inhabitants of Sidon, or Alab, or Aksib, or Helba, or Aphek, or Rehob. So the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites in the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Success or failure?
Failure.
Failure. Verse 33. Nor did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, or the inhabitants of Beth Anath. But they dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath were put under tribute to them. Success or failure?
Failure.
Failure. Verse 34 through 36. And the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains, for they would not allow them to come down to the valley. Okay. And the Amorites were determined to dwell in Mount Heriz, in Ajalon, in Shealbim. Yet when the strength of the house of Joseph became greater, they were put under tribute. Now the boundaries of the Amorites was from the ascent of Akrabim, from Selah, and upwards. Success or failure? Oh, come on, guys. It's an utter failure here. Not only in this last part, the tribe of Dan is such a sad story. They were supposed to be given this piece of land, and what they decided to do is say, you know what? We're just going to give up on that piece of land. We're going to go find another piece of land. We're not going to take the land that God gave us. We're just going to run away and find another piece of land. And you're going to see this later on at the very end of the book of Judges, okay? So it gets worse and worse. Do you see the transition? In the very beginning, there's a success. Some compromises, some editing of God's commands. But it seems like they're having victory over the land. But then it gets a little bit sketchy, where now they allow them to come alongside them and tolerate them. And I'm going to put you under tribute. And we're going to now live alongside you and be okay with it. And we're just going to kind of occupy the same pace. And then, you know what? You're just too big to conquer, so we're going to run away. And if we look at the Israelites called to go and take the promised land, where God said, I will give you this. I will give you victory if you depend on me and not your own strength. You still have a part to play. You still have to make the choice to go in and trust in me. But if you will trust me and believe I'm big enough to conquer your enemies, you'll conquer everything. And what we see is they get a miserable F minus, right? If we look, now again, I've changed this from the one that's in your outline. If you look at the successes and failures, if I was being actually generous, which I should have been in the very beginning, I changed some of them. You had 9 successful occupations of the land and 9 failures. 9 divided by 18 is what? This isn't hard. 50%, right? 50% success. Mission accomplished, all right. No. If you were to ask any English teacher, any mathematics teacher, any history teacher, any science teacher, if you got a 50% on a test, what grade would you get? Yeah. An F? not just an F, I'd give you an F minus, right? Utter failure. Did they trust God to help them conquer the promised land? To have victory in the call that God had given them? No. Their campaign ended in failure, and it was multiple reasons why it was a failure. Sometimes they edited God's commands. Sometimes they compromised with the culture. Sometimes they said, well, we conquered you, but we'll allow you to stay. Sometimes they said, you know what, you're too big to conquer, I'll just live alongside you. And then at other times they said, you are just too big to conquer, I'll run away. And I'll allow you to have the victory in my life. It's the same thing that can happen to us, isn't it, as we walk with Christ. When we walk with Christ, especially in the very beginning years of our Christian walk, you usually have a lot of successes, don't you? And it's exciting. Man, my language is changing, the way I think is changing, the way I act towards other people are changing. I'm even maybe dressing a little bit different, listening to different music, watching things that are a little bit more appropriate and letting go of things. I want to do good things to others. I'm not always thinking of myself. I'm actually being nice to my wife or my husband now. I actually like my kids sometimes, right? I actually like my parents sometimes. There's some changes in our lives. And we're like, yes, this is exciting. Man, God's having victory in my life. But then you start walking with Christ for a while, and then all of a sudden you start to have to really deal with those dark, deep places of yourself that you've tried to ignore. But God starts shining the light in your heart, doesn't he? He's like, hey, Peter, it's time to deal with that one. No, God. No, that's too big. It's too hard. I'm not ready for that right now. Okay. Let's deal with this one. Then he comes back to that. All right, Peter, it's time to deal with this one. No. God, it's just too hard for me. It's too big for me. I mean, I can't do it by myself. I can't do it at all, in fact. And we make excuse after excuse after excuse. And if we do that in a Christian walk, if we do exactly what the Israelites did, where they had this call from God himself to go and have victory, and we allow our culture and our own flesh to get in the way, we will experience heartache in this life, just like the Israelites did. Let me show you the heartache that they experienced. We're going to read chapter 2, verses 1 through 5. Look at, after all of this, this is the consequences of their actions of not taking the promised land. And it is absolutely depressing. It says in verse 1 of chapter 2, then the angel of the Lord, and what I want you to do there, actually, I know this is kind of crazy, I want you to cross out angel and put messenger, because the term angel can confuse you in this verse thinking that this is an actual angel, and I don't believe it's an angel. I believe that this is actually the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ speaking at this moment. It shows up a lot in the Old Testament. Not every time necessarily where it says the angel of the Lord is the pre-incarnate Christ, but I believe in this situation right here, this is actually Jesus coming to the Israelites and telling them something. It says, then the messenger of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I led you up from Egypt. That was a huge deal, right? They were in slavery in Egypt. They were prisoners, and he rescued them and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers. I am a covenant-keeping God. I promised Abraham this land years ago. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. So you can trust me that I'll follow through with that. Whatever I tell you to do, you will have victory. And you were supposed to not make covenants with the inhabitants of this land. You were supposed to tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Therefore, I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare to you. So it was, when the messenger of the Lord spoke these words to all the children of Israel, that the people lifted up their voices and wept. Then they called the name of that place Bochim, which means weeping, and they sacrificed there to the Lord. Do you see how the consequence for them not trusting and depending on God to give them victory was that the Canaanite culture now would become a trap? It would snare them and stop them from living fully for God. And God's going to do this for a reason, because it was there, we're going to see later on in chapter 2, as a test to them. He allowed them to stay, to test them, to see if they would reject the world's culture and depend on God and His will. This was the consequences the Israelites experienced. And it wasn't just the generation that went in to the land to conquer it that experienced these consequences. It was their children, their grandchildren, and generations to come. Do you see that when you fail to trust God and depend on Him to give you victory in the call that He's given you in your life, that it doesn't just have impact on you alone. It has impact on your children, your grandchildren, and generations to come. That's scary. Now, of course, they still have to make their choice to follow Christ. They still have ownership of their own actions. But your actions don't just have consequences for yourself. If we fail to live for Christ now and depend on God to have victory in our lives, it doesn't just hurt us. It hurts everybody who comes after you. If anything, God is saying, please consider this. I will give you victory. And so right now, we live in a culture that's pulling you away from the things of God. It's pulling you away from His way and saying, do it your way or do it their way. It doesn't matter. Just go and do whatever you want. And God says, don't buy into that. Because the consequence for you in our culture today is that will become a snare for you. You'll be trapped. You know how a snare works, right? The animal like puts its head or its leg in the snare and it wraps around it and it yoinks it up. That's what happens when we allow the culture to infect our worldview, how we live our life, what's valuable to us. When we let the culture impact our values, when it makes us believe a certain thing that is untrue from a biblical perspective, from God's perspective, it becomes a snare. Not just for you, but you teach the falsehood to your kids, your grandkids, your nephews, your nieces, and generations to come are impacted. And God puts that there not to be mean to you, but to teach you a lesson when you aren't dying to yourself and having victory in Him. If you just depend on your own willpower to follow Christ, this is what I have found in my life. I actually had to, this is the phrase that has changed my life over time, but it was a learned thing that took years. It didn't just happen in an instant for me. Maybe for some of you it happened in an instant. It's actually two phrases I remind myself over and over again. Peter, you need to die. Peter, you can't live. Because that part of you is your flesh. That's your sin nature. That thing wants to rebel against God. Peter, you need to die. And what you need is Christ. I am a needy individual. And that was the hardest thing for me to admit. I'm a proud American. Man, I'm independent. I can do things myself. I can do it alone. I don't need anybody. Some of you aren't like that, but a lot of us are, right? I could do it myself. I'm strong enough, because if I'm not strong enough, then I'm not a man, or I'm not, you know, an American. But we don't realize that God did not make us to be independent and self-sufficient. We do not have what it takes. I have to remind myself that over and over again, because I fall into that trap. It's a snare for me over and over again. I get caught in it. And it sounds really good. You got what it takes. Be all you can be, right? That's the army slogan. Like, you know, we're told and inundated by our culture to believe this truth that you have everything you need to be successful in this life. That is a lie from the devil, even though it sounds really good. You do not have what it takes. The Israelites, when they went in that land to conquer it, did not in themselves have what it took to conquer that land. They needed God. That was the hardest thing for me to learn. And this is the prayer I say often over and over, God, Lord, I need to die and I need to now live in Christ. That's such a simple term, but it's something that has taken me years to fully kind of flesh out and live. Because do you realize that you had to be born again, right? You were once dead. Can dead things do anything? No. So why do you try to keep living out of your dead body that died on the cross with Christ? Why do you try to do things out of your own willpower? If I just try harder, I'll have victory over the sin. No, you won't. You won't. You'll fail eventually. You'll let yourself down. If you trust other people to help you, they'll let you down. Don't worry. I think we've all experienced this. If you're not old enough to experience it, don't worry. You have a life full of misery in the beginning, in the future. But it's okay, because that is supposed to teach us to die to ourselves and recognize, God, I need you. I absolutely desperately need you. I can't do this without Jesus. If it wasn't for him, I'd be stuck in my dead body and I would be dead. Things do nothing. But now you are alive in Christ. There is something new in you, your new nature, right? And now you can live what we talked about in the book of Philippians before, the out-resurrection life. Now even, not out of your own power, but because the power is coming from God through the power of the Holy Spirit, and now it overflows out of you. Whenever I try to do things in my own power, I find that I feel like I'm being sucked dry. There's always excuses, like either it becomes exhausting because I'm trying too hard, or I just say I'm not going to even try because it's too difficult when I'm trying to do things in my own power. But man, when I do things in the strength of God, and it's taken me a long time to figure this out, so you might be saying, how do you figure that out? It's connecting the head and the heart and dying to yourself. It's a process. It doesn't just happen instantly. It's trying to learn how to live out of that new nature, not your sin nature. It just takes a while. But it is possible. God would have given victory to the Israelites if they had depended on him. We need to do the same thing. Let me just, I know we're running out of time, but I just want to point out this one thing that's quite amazing, because I like to geek out on historic stuff. Gilgal. Did you see that the messenger of the Lord, which I believe is Jesus Christ, came from Gilgal to Bochim, place of weeping? I don't know where Bochim is. It's probably pretty close to Gilgal. Gilgal is huge to the Israelites. It was the place that the Israelites crossed over the Jordan, where they stacked up the 12 stones to declare God's glory. It was where the tabernacle like was at this time. It was where God gave Joshua the plans to go take Jericho, and the people had victory conquering Jericho with the walls falling down. And God meets them there and goes out to a place of weeping. I find that actually just ironic in a sense. God has to go from where he met them in a unique, special place to another location where all the Israelites can do is weep and cry and plead to God for help. This is how we walk often as a Christian in our life. We have these moments in our lives where there's great victory, where God has met us, where we stack up 12 stones and say, look what God has done. And then we wander away from God, and then he comes back to Bochim, the place of weeping, where we're going, God, why is life so miserable? Why am I not having victory? Why am I not doing this? And he says, why did you do these things? I told you I was with you. I told you I'd give you victory, but you allowed the culture to infect you. You allowed it to impact you, to change your values. You decided that, you know what, excuses are good reasons why I shouldn't follow Jesus, why tolerance is okay, that I should allow sin in my life. And you get to a place where I have to meet you, where all you can do is weep. Now the beauty is we're going to see in the book of Judges, that even though you might make the same mistake over and over again, God's still working. He's still there in it all. He hears your cries. He's a compassionate God. In fact, he responds, it seems like a lot in Judges, because he hears the cries, and like a loving father, he is moved to tears and says, I wish my child did not make this mistake. I will meet you where you're at, and I will give you victory if you turn back and look to me. We're going to see that thread throughout the whole book of Judges, that God is not absent in this all, but that he's there all the way with them. So here's what I want you to think of. Follow through with what God calls you to do, or you will suffer heartache in this life. That's what we see in this section. That's what the Israelites experience. That's what we can experience. And just briefly, This is what I want you to think through, meditate on, and wrestle with God about. Your success to live out God's call in your life is not based on your efforts alone. That's what I've been trying to say to you. It is first based off of your dependence on God. If you are not depending on God to give you victory, you will eventually fail. Or you become a proud narcissist that think you're the hottest thing on earth, okay? And then you're just a big loser, okay? Your success to live out God's call in your life is directly correlated with your dependence on God. Now, what has God called us to do? I won't go into this in detail, but do you know that there are over 1,000 commands just in the New Testament from Jesus and Paul and others that God has called us to do? And I can feel overwhelming, like, am I doing all of them? I might be missing some of them. Oh my goodness, I can't believe this. There's 1,000. I got to go look now and figure out what they are. No, that's not what I'm saying you should do, okay? This is not something where we should become like the Pharisees during Jesus' time, where they were so caught up in following the letter of the law that they made more laws so they wouldn't break the law. And Jesus goes to them and he goes, you hypocrites, you whitewashed tombs. You're dead on the inside, but you look pretty on the outside. That's not what we're supposed to do. Jesus says the spirit of the law is what you're missing. Sabbath wasn't made so that you need to follow it. You need to follow it. You have to rest or you're disobeying God. No. Man was not made for the Sabbath. Sabbath was made for man. So there's a spirit to the law, and it kind of comes down to these three big things. And Jesus says these in some essence. And the great commandments and the great commission. Here it just boils down to this, the spirit of the law. Love God. Love others. Make disciples. That's what God has called you to do. And you can't do this on your own. Because if you try to do it in your own flesh, you'll fail. But if you do depend on God, he will give victory in these areas. Now next week, we're going to look at the rest of Judges chapter 2 and see the cycle of destruction and suffering we can get ourselves into if we don't make this change. So let's pray. God, Lord, we are fallible people. We make bad choices over and over again. And one of those bad choices is we don't depend on you for success in the calls that you've given us in our life. God, if there's people here today that feel like a failure, first and foremost, Lord, I pray that you would come and stand beside them, take their hand, and you let them know you love them, that you have not rejected them, that you will walk beside them. They just need to come back to you and trust you, depend on you. Lord, if there's Christians here this morning who are having victory in their life right now, help them rejoice in that and hold on to that and let those victories sustain them, but recognize that there will be further future challenges that will tempt them to depend on their own strength or to compromise. Lord, help them to have wisdom and to turn to you in dependence in neediness when they face those challenges and temptation comes along. Oh God, we need you. Oh, how we need you. We desperately need you to live this calling that you've given us, to be like Jesus, to make disciples, to love you and love others, Lord. We cannot do this on our own. Lord, help us to die to ourselves and live in Jesus Christ. It's in his name that we can even pray any of these things. Amen.